From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we get a new view of an old master. We'll talk with author Mark Linkford, who explores the genius of Leonardo da Vinci in a new book.
Later, how a Midwestern teenager's obsession with the golden age of Hollywood turned into a book 40 years later.
So here we were, literally June of 1978. We made this first sojourn via St. Paul to Los Angeles to interview the screen legends Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly.
And the author of Milwaukee Ghosts and Legends talks about some of the local spirits and things that connect ghost stories of all kinds.
There are definitely reoccurring themes, and I think it's because at the heart of all ghost stories, it's a human story.
Lake Effect comes your way next, but first, this news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Teich. The word genius gets thrown around a lot in casual conversation. Even when you weed out subjects like managerial geniuses or musical geniuses, there are some transcendent figures we typically file under the genius category. People like Albert Einstein and Mozart and Stephen Hawking and Leonardo da Vinci.
But lumping all these people into the blanket genius category strips them of their individuality and can make it difficult for us to process both what they accomplished and what we can learn from them. Writer Mark Linkford doesn't necessarily consider himself a genius, but he has written a book called Becoming Leonardo, an exploded view of the life of Leonardo da Vinci, which gives us some uncommon insights into the man behind the Mona Lisa and The Last Supper.
He talked about the book in Milwaukee last month, but joined us first on the line from his home in Oregon. He explains what he was trying to do with this book that hadn't already been done many times in the 500 years since Leonardo's death.
I tried to get much closer to Leonardo than I had been able to through other biographies. I've read just an endless number of books about Leonardo, and they all follow the same format. They're academic. They are thematic. They separate his life out into component parts so that the painting is different from his travel or something. And I had no real sense of the man, so I wanted to look at these facts and research around them to get as close to Leonardo as possible.
What kind of eyes did you think you brought to the project?
Before I embarked on this,
yeah.
I had the standard view of Leonardo as a Superman, as someone who is almost of an unlimited talent, of an extraordinarily famous person, charismatic, a giant. And yet, my entire life, I've read biographies of creative artists and discoverers, inventors, thinkers, and I've developed a profile of the creative personality, which, of course, I also get from psychology texts and other things. And the odd thing about Leonardo is he simply doesn't fit any other example out there, at least as rendered by art historians. So the eyes I bring to Leonardo are the eyes outside the institution. The institutional Leonardo is a very narrow kind of character developed over the century by art historians. And frankly, I come to Leonardo from terms of character development. I went to the Iowa Writers Workshop. I have a strong sense of narrative, and I've studied narrative my entire life. So I know that if you want to get close to a character, you have to develop the character up close. So as, and this is the important thing, to get to his reasons, the causation behind the act. When you normally read an academic biography of Leonardo, when it gets to what prompted all of this, you'll be told it was curiosity or genius. That tells you nothing. I wanted to get down on the ground with the man, eyeball to eyeball, and look at what stimulated him, what he was responding to, what occurred not just in front of him, but on either side and behind him. You need to know the entire environment to know how he reacted to the environment, and the world then was very different than it is now.
Well, and there's an inherent challenge here because there's not a ton of evidence of his early life, is there?
He lived during a time of 95% illiteracy. So the people he was around did not record the experience of knowing Leonardo. But But that said, there's a tremendous amount of study around Leonardo. The curious thing for me is that art historians don't usually avail themselves of it. There are studies, for instance, about the development of the modern shoe and the modern heel and how it changed how people walked. We walk heel to toe. Back then, they walked toe to heel, simply because they didn't have that robust modern heel. They slept differently than we do. They slept in two shifts as opposed to one. It was an age before coffee or stimulation. One of the gigantic differences between modern biographers and the experience on the ground then is that we are tremendously stimulated. We are, if anything, overstimulated. Leonardo spent half his life in the dark.
Well, and one of the other interesting points you make is about how rare representational art was in his time. We just don't see, or they just did not see the number of images that we see on a daily basis.
True. And the fascinating thing there is before the advent of the modern mirror, the cheap mirror, people in that environment, I mean, imagine not having a mirror. What that means is 99% of the population throughout the course of human history had never seen the back of their own head. It requires two mirrors to do that. And if one is expensive, you would never have the experience. It was a world where art of any sort was rare and precious and locked up.
And so I gather the images that people did see had really a profound effect on them in a way that we just, an individual image would never have that kind of effect on us or rarely have that kind of effect on us today.
Exactly. We swim in images. But 500 years ago, a well-crafted image had magic. So the effect just of any artist at that time was almost magical. To consider Leonardo at that time, a man still considered one of the greatest, if not the greatest, draftsman in Western history, the ability to draw something and make it compelling and real was true magic.
We've been fascinated with Leonardo for a long time, but the picture you paint of the man is of really a guy that's kind of both an outsider, and when he does get commissions, he doesn't necessarily aim to please. He's not necessarily great at follow-through?
Very much so. I think he's a prototypical outsider. Now, the critical thing there is to recognize that at that point in time it was the emergence of the modern individual. One of the remarkable things about Leonardo is that he is one of the first standalone individuals in art. So he had a sense of himself that was distinct from other people. He came to art fairly late for the time. He was 15 years old before he entered into an apprenticeship. He was never part of that insider circle in Florence, the Medici circle. Verrocchio, Michelangelo, others got commissions from the Medici's. Leonardo did not. Leonardo had to leave Florence, basically, because he was not able to succeed there. And went to Milan. And then the old story about Milan was he came and was welcomed by the court and was instantly famous. The reality, you discover, is he was there almost 8 years before he started getting court commissions. So there was something about the man, and I come back to this time and again in the book, there's something about the man we cannot see. That the reaction others had to him in person is something that's been lost to history. All we can do is judge those reactions, and we know he was not instantly hired. In fact, in the case of Milan, Ludovico Sforza tried to get rid of him twice. Leonardo was a man who did not perform on schedule. He was moved by inspiration. He was moved by his own processes, which were probably a mystery to him. He lived not just in a pre-Freudian world, and if you've known your grandparents or your great grandparents, you know what they were, how they talked about the emotions. It's a very different language than we have. You go 500 years back, the emotion psychology was a very alien thing. How did you recognize in yourself? And I think what happened with Leonardo is he recognized how to stimulate himself. The Mona Lisa is a great example. The Mona Lisa does not make sense as a realistic painting for a variety of reasons. The light's coming from the wrong direction. The view out the window is a half mile in the air. There are all kinds of odd things about this painting, but it works. And the reason it works is that psychologically everything blends together. So I think Leonardo's discovery there was, if I put this next to that, I see a third thing. How is that? And he would come back and test it and test it. So the ultimate test for Leonardo, the ultimate subject for Leonardo, was himself. How he reacted to art, or how his body reacted to the world.
He's introspective in a way that other people 500 years ago were not.
Yes, exactly.
Another interesting point you make is that, and I'm quoting here, for some reason, regular people weren't hiring Leonardo, but perverse maniacs were. What should we make of the people that he was able to either connect with or be hired by versus the ones that did not connect with him?
Well, the people, the ordinary administrators who did not hire Leonardo didn't have to. People who hired Leonardo were Cesare Borgia and Ludovico Sforza primarily, had access to other engineers and architects and were not able to get from them exactly what they wanted. And Leonardo held out promise for a different method or a fresh start. He was outside the ordinary guilds, let's say.
Right.
If you wanted an imaginative a kind of weapon design, what you would get from most engineers, and there were 11 other engineers that worked for Ludovico Sforza in Milan, but what they produced were visions of the past. With Leonardo, he had that willingness to envision something that had not been made, but then most importantly, make it look real because of that enormous ability to draw. You know, and that's another thing about Leonardo, just as an aside. You know, Einstein gets credit for the thought experiment, for being able to work out intangibles in his head. And yet, 400 years before that, Leonardo was doing the same thing, but with his drawings. He would hypothetically assemble things and then draw them out to resolve conflicts, but were never built. Most of the designs that Leonardo drew were never built.
He was not also really much of a self-promoter. So when does his legacy get burnished to the degree? I mean, he doesn't necessarily think of things for posterity. He kind of he makes these drawings and squirrels them away. When does he become the transcendent figure that he is today?
Well, it was in the 1800s. When Leonardo died, he was forgotten for a couple hundred years. He had not published anything. I mean, one of the critical things to understand about Leonardo are that the discoveries he made were not published, so that in his anatomical drawings, he uncovered a tripart valve in the heart, which was not actually verified until the 1900s. But he had uncovered it through this marvelous intuition he had, but he did not publish it. The entire effort of putting together a coherent manuscript and publishing it was somehow beyond him. His ability to persuade people to hire him failed more often than not. And yet the man never stopped creating for himself. That's the fascination about Leonardo, is that he routinely was trying to make sense of this world, and he lived in the midst of chaos. And one of the fascinating things at this distance is that all we have of Leonardo are bits and pieces. But if you look at the pieces, they include things like the Mona Lisa. How do you account for that? I mean, if there's only 14 paintings and they're all separated by large gaps in time, how do you account for the gaps? That's the miracle of Leonardo, is we have only enough evidence to suggest something marvelous behind it all, but we can't quite get to it.
The metaphor that kept coming to mind as I was reading this book was like a 500-year-old jigsaw puzzle with pieces still missing. What are the pieces that are the most important pieces that are still missing for you?
Well, there are half of the notebooks are missing. What we know of his projects are very indirect. For instance, of all the anatomy drawings that we have of human anatomy, he apparently did an entire manuscript on horse anatomy. He spent years in Milan dissecting horses and drawing them up, and nothing of that survives. He was a metallurgist. He invented an early kind of plastic made out of gypsum, which has been lost. But the fascinating thing about Leonardo is you have these bits and pieces that pretty much dispersed at his death. They went to his apprentice, Melsey, and when Melsey died, his sons just sold everything off. So Leonardo was scattered all over Europe, and for a couple of hundred years, that's you had to have access to a library to even find anything of Leonardo's. But then Walter Pater came along, and Walter Pater, it was Victorian studies that recovered Leonardo. And Walter Pater wrote an essay on the Mona Lisa that is just magical. I read it in grad school, and I avoided it the entire time I was writing the book because I knew that if I looked at that essay, it would find its way into the book. But that is what Leonardo does. Part of Leonardo's magic is how he excites the imagination from this distance. There's so much more that excites us, but we cannot lay hands on it. But it's the connective pieces between Mona Lisa and his machine drawings and his water studies and his horse anatomies. That's the Leonardo that we only get in pieces.
You're saying what's missing is just as important as what's there.
Yes, absolutely. And the more you read Leonardo, the more you're pulled into his life. And the more you recognize how different he was from many modern people. We look at Leonardo and we ask, why are there no more Leonardos? Or we look at Leonardo and we imagine a modern person who multitasks like an octopus or something. But the reality is Leonardo was very unique, and he was self-made. And he came up in a time where people had no support system. He was an illegitimate child. He was largely self-educated. He wrote backwards with his left hand, which was a mark of Satanism at the time. I mean, priests in at that age could not baptize children if they were left-handed. Leonardo was very much a self-construction, but on the other hand, he had profound limitations. He couldn't write to the lord of the castle to offer work. He had to function in the society like an illiterate person and hire a scribe to write a letter to be sent out. Today, if Leonardo was coming up, you would have, basically from a social welfare point of view, you would have a 15-year-old child raised in the country, not educated, who wrote backwards, and difficulty not just with writing, probably with reading. He was probably profoundly dyslexic. A Leonardo today would have been institutionalized. He would have been corrected in some kind of way. And not to romanticize it, it would have been a good thing 99% of the time, but in Leonardo's case, something unique came out of that self-construction.
Absolutely. Well, Mike Langford, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Mike Langford's new book is called Becoming Leonardo, an exploded view of the life of Leonardo da Vinci, and he talked about it last month at the Charles Alice Art Museum. He spoke with us from Oregon.
A quick break now, and then we'll chat with Dave Fantle about his four-decade quest to interview the screen legends of Hollywood's golden age. Lake Effect returns in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. The golden age of Hollywood ran from 1929, when the talkies were introduced, to the 1960s. Film stars were groomed and promoted by a studio system that could be both supportive and exploitive. When the studios began to break up in the 60s, many of the stars they made famous were entering their old age. Some were still working by the late 70s, others were happily or not retired. But they were still accessible to fans in a way that today's celebrities are not.
And that's where our next guest comes in. For the past four decades, Dave Fantle has been asking for and getting interviews with some of Hollywood's best-loved stars. And those interviews were published this year in a book called Hollywood Heyday, 75 Candid Interviews with Golden Age Legends. Lake Effect's Bonnie North caught up with him back in July and talked about his love for the subject.
Dave Fantle, it's great to see you.
Good to see you, Bonnie.
And normally I'm seeing you in a very different context, but in this case, it's about something you're doing and have done for 40 years.
My avocation and not my vocation, because you're right. My day job, I'm chief marketing officer for UPAF, United Performing Arts Fund. But for the past 40 plus years, my outside passion has been the golden age of Hollywood.
Well, and you started as a teenager in mm-hmm. the Twin Cities, mm-hmm. somehow deciding that it was perfectly cool to write to all of these famous people and say, hey, we'd like to interview you. Now, this is done with a friend.
Yes.
And somehow they said yes.
Pretty astonishing when you think about it today, right? So, and I tell audiences, and they're just can't believe it. When we saw That's Entertainment very briefly in 1974, the compilation of all the great MGM movie musicals, we were 15 years old, living in St. Paul, and we became sort of hooked on the classics. So here we were about to graduate high school in 1978. And as you said, my friend and co-writer Tom Johnson and I said, you know, many stars of the golden age are in their golden years, but they're still very much alive. And would it be possible to actually meet them? So we did. Today seems pretty outrageous. We would actually send a letter with a self-addressed stamped envelope to the home addresses of people like Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly.
Well, how did you find the home addresses?
Well, back then there were actually source books that told you that Gene Kelly was at 725 North Rodale Drive and Fred Astaire was on San Ysidro Drive, and you know how you got stars' homes maps and different things like that. So you could get access to their home addresses. So we'd put the postage on the self-addressed stamped envelope, and lo and behold, they would respond. Now, they wouldn't always respond in the affirmative, but they would respond. And in the case of Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly, in the summer or just before the summer of 1978, they green-lighted visits to Los Angeles. So here we were, literally June of 1978. So 40 years ago, almost to this date, we made this first sojourn via St. Paul to Los Angeles to interview the screen legends Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly.
And you couldn't have started with two better people.
Exactly. Or more revered.
Or more revered.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And because they were so revered, and having that photo taken with Fred Astaire, it opened so many doors for us. And over 200 interviews followed, and about 60 of them happened between 78 and 83 when we were college journalists for the Minnesota Daily, which was a large daily newspaper at the University of Minnesota. And don't forget, and you know, Bonnie, 35, 40 years ago, stars from the golden era were 35, 40 years closer than they are today. So it was not unheard of for us as college students to have film societies and to appreciate the golden age of Hollywood. It's a bigger leap today with younger audiences, and I certainly can vouch for that. I'm teaching some film classes at Marquette, that it is really an education to get them to see some of the classics today.
Well, and a slight digression, mm-hmm. some of the classics, I think of Busby Berkeley and, mm-hmm. and the kinds of film techniques that were developed. I mean, they were revolutionary at the time, and in some ways they still are. So there's a lot to learn. It's not just enjoyment to go back. If you're actually a film scholar or you're studying it, there's a lot to see and a lot to learn.
Exactly. And, you know, it's really incumbent upon young people, if they're interested in that field, to know its history. And you'd be astonished to know that they don't know Charlie Chaplin or they don't know John Ford. And you're exactly right. The work of these artists paved the way. I mean, who idolizes John Ford more than a Steven Spielberg? So it's very important to know. And in our book, Rod Steiger told the story. Here he is, won an Academy Award for In the Heat of the Night, playing this sort of racist Southern sheriff. And he was reinventing himself toward the end of his life in the mid-90s. He found himself talking to these young studio executives that maybe had a business MBA from an Ivy League school. And the question they would ask Rod Steiger is, can you do a Southern accent? No clue about the industry's history.
Well, and even though you didn't set out to write an industry history, in a way you have. And, you know, looking at all of the different folks you got to talk to, anyone who loves movies would be sitting there going, oh, I wish I could have been in the room. Was there ever anyone who disappointed you?
No. No one disappointed us, because I think they were groomed on the studio system, so they were always very media and fan-friendly when it became to accessibility. I think when Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly opened the door, and our book, Hollywood Heyday, is simply dedicated to Fred and Gene, because we wouldn't be talking about this subject. I wouldn't be at Marquette and what have you if it wasn't for those first two meetings with Astaire and Kelly. The genius of Fred Astaire is the fact that he was so unaware of his genius. He had no interest in dissecting or really talking about things that he did 20, 30, 40, 50 years earlier. And was there a greater artist, a greater genius in the field of dance than Fred Astaire? But he was totally unaware of it.
Well, and what was interesting in that particular interview, he did talk about how they did that dancing on the ceiling scene, but he was more talking about not what he did, but what all the tech people had to do. And the cameraman had
and
to
do. And that's the famous scene from Royal Wedding where the room moved with the camera. And one of the last survivors of that golden age is the director of that sequence, Stanley Donen, who about 30 years after he did the sequence with Astaire, did Dancing on the Ceiling with Lionel Richie. The exact same technique, not using computers, not using high tech, just did the same thing that they did in 1952 in Royal Wedding.
One of the ones I found most interesting was your conversation with Lucille Ball. Mm-hmm. You talk about finding her very, not prickly, but direct.
Mm-hmm.
And did that surprise you when you arrived at her house?
Well, sometimes you went to the funny people thinking that they would be on and they would be funny. And it was certainly true with people like Milton Berle and George Burns, or Mel Brooks for that matter. But in the case of two iconic comedic stars, and that's Lucille Ball and Bob Hope, they were probably two of the least funny people you'd ever meet. The reason I think Lucille Ball was not particularly funny is she really broke the glass ceiling for women in the entertainment industry. And people forget that she started Desilu Productions with her husband at the time, Desi Arnaz. She was more of a businesswoman in a male-dominated environment beyond just performing in I Love Lucy. And when we asked her about ad-libbing and slapstick and all the craziness, she said, first of all, I want to make it clear. There were very few episodes in which we did the shtick and the slapstick, even though we remember that. And she said, as it pertains to the script and the stories, the writers knew our characters intimately. There was no ad-libbing. And by 1968, she sold Desilu Productions to the parent company of Paramount Pictures for, at that time, the princely sum of $18 million. So she was extremely savvy, extremely smart in a male-dominated environment, and not particularly funny. And I think the transition to Bob Hope, definitely one of the great comedic icons and entertainment icons of the 20th century, but he was known to be incredibly media accessible, but to really say nothing. We had him for a long interview late at night when he was in the Twin Cities, and he was shockingly frank with us about films he liked, films he didn't like, and it was shortly after Reagan was shot, and he, as a well-known conservative, came out as a strong advocate for gun control. And those are the subject matters he actually talked about in our interview, which is certainly not characteristic of the Bob Hope that was interviewed by many other media outlets.
Right, the Vanity Fair type of things, or a Hollywood Reporter, or one of
you'd
those.
Ask him a question and he would be oblivious to the question and promote the show. That was typically what Bob Hope did.
Why do you think people were so honest with you and so open? Not just accessibility, but to actually get those kinds of interviews.
Well, I think in some respects we had youth on our side, especially for that first round of interviews while we were college students. The other thing that we did, Bonnie, is that because of sort of the golden age of Hollywood, we actually bought our first suits in the Twin Cities. And so there wasn't an interview that we didn't go to back in those days where we didn't afford these people the respect of coming with a suit and tie on. And I think the fact that we were young and had an inordinate amount of knowledge on their careers helped in comparison to maybe some young journalists today who might be interviewing a celebrity like, let's say, Jerry Lewis or something a year or two ago, who would really have no sense of their history or really what to ask. Robert Wagner, who wrote our foreword, was a perfect example. That came about just a couple years ago when we got to RJ, what he lets us call him. The publicist said, you know, you have 30 minutes. She would check in 30 minutes and go, we're having a great time, go away. Over 2 hours elapsed. And it not only was such a rich interview that's in the book, but he said, can I write the foreword? So I think the fact that that he was probably used to people interviewing about playing in Austin Powers and things like that, that for someone to go back and talk to him about working with John Ford in What Price Glory, he was pleasantly surprised.
I think in some ways, my sense of it, having read the book now, is that you disarmed them. And it's true with interviews today. Most people don't get below the surface. Mm-hmm. They want, you know, they say, tell me about your book, as opposed to having read your book.
Yeah, and I remember when we first met Gene Kelly in 78, and then we had a second interview at his home the second time, probably 15 years later. And the first thing he said, and here we were, what, 35 to 40 years old, the first thing he said is, the college boys are back. So it's like 15 years had not elapsed.
Is there one that got away that you are sorry that you didn't get into the book?
Well, I have a fun note because it shows the accessibility of these stars of the Golden Age. A handwritten note from Henry Fonda that said, I'm sorry I won't be in L.A. when you're here. I'll be in New Hampshire making a movie. And, of course, it was on Golden Pond when he won an Academy Award, finally. And so I think it shows a little bit to the class and personality. But, I mean, certainly, you know, the fact that we couldn't get to Johnny Carson, that we couldn't get to a John Wayne, that you couldn't get to a Katharine Hepburn, or an Orson Welles. There were certainly stars of great artists that we didn't get to, but when we look back at the 200 plus and the 75 that are in the book, we're pretty pleased by who we did manage to meet.
I know this is Hollywood heyday and golden age, but have you thought about doing this now? Are there people who interest you now that you'd want to talk to?
Well, there are certainly people of that ilk that are in the golden age of now, like a De Niro, a Pacino, a Dustin Hoffman,
a Streep.
But the reality is, Bonnie, it's a different day. Their accessibility is still, because of the handlers, because of the entourage that shields them, you can't go into them and get the kind of access that we had, you know, going back 30 and 40 years. And it's a shame. And so to say we've retired from interviewing individual celebrities is pretty much an accurate description because, again, we really have no much more interest because, and you know, working with celebrities and publicists, the publicists of today, I'm sad to say, having worked in public relations for decades, they've taken the fun out of it. And I don't want to work with these young publicists anymore. They're just very difficult.
So this is
this is the final wrapping.
I was going to say, this is the final wrap, and that's your golden age.
It's our golden age, and it is a wrap. And we understand that it is a niche audience, but I am pleased to do a lot of speaking to, you know, at senior facilities. So those are people who actually lived this. I went to a retirement facility, and a woman came up to me and said, I was Charlton Heston's teacher at New Trier High School in Wilmette, Illinois. Now, of course, she was in her late 90s, but it was incredibly lucid, and it was great that she came up to me. But then the other side of the scale is I have an opportunity to equate young college students at Marquette with some of these Golden Age classics. And surprisingly, some of them actually come up to me and compare notes with their grandparents and said, I saw Casablanca last night, or my grandpa knew Bing Crosby from Spokane, Washington. So it's very fulfilling to have that kind of feedback, even from the younger people.
So it goes on. Even though this is a wrap, it continues.
It goes on.
Well, Dave Fannell, it is so great to talk to you about something other than UPAF, even though UPAF is a wonderful thing to talk about. But best of luck with the book. Thank you so much for coming in.
Anytime. Thanks, Bonnie.
Dave Fantle is the director of marketing for the United Performing Arts Fund, but his passion is the golden age of Hollywood, and his recent book is called Hollywood Heyday, 75 Candid Interviews with Golden Age Legends. He talked with Bonnie North in July.
One more break, and then we'll chat with the author of a new book on what might be haunting Milwaukee buildings. Lake Effect returns in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. Scary stories are a classic part of childhood. A whistling wind or a bump in the night heighten the drama of these tales and keep listeners coming back for more.
Like a lot of kids, Anna Lardinoy loved these stories, but unlike a lot of adults, she's made her living through telling them. Lardinoy is the founder of Gothic Milwaukee, through which she gives haunted, historical walking tours of the city.
She is also the author of Milwaukee Ghosts and Legends. She spoke with me recently about her new book and what first drew her to ghostly tales.
I've loved ghost stories ever since I was a little kid. When I was growing up, we used to take turns telling each other scary stories and seeing who could be the scariest. And I always loved that activity. I would keep up late at night being so scared about the stories that I already told that I knew I made up. So I've just always been intrigued by that genre. And as I got older, I made doing ghost tours part of my vacations. So every new city I'd go to, I'd go to a haunted walking tour because I think it's a really fun way to learn history in the city and take a different look at new places. So with all that love of the storytelling and that ghostly aspect, I've started Gothic Milwaukee, my walking tours here. And in gathering all of those tales, I had a number of stories that really didn't fit into tours. So a book seemed like a great way to share them with people.
Yeah. So you've taken a number of tours around the country, I'm assuming.
Mm-hmm. Even the world. Yes.
Are there recurring themes that
Absolutely.
You see?
Absolutely. I was actually just talking about this week, how almost every classic theater is a haunted theater, and they're all haunted in almost always the same ways. There is always, you know, an actor who still has not taken their last bow. There is always a stage manager who is still watching over the house. There is always someone in the lighting room in all of these theaters in all over the country. And philosophically, it's hard to understand why that is. Is that part of nature that, you know, these people fill these roles? Is it part of our collective imagination? It's hard to know exactly why that is, but there are definitely reoccurring themes. And I think it's because at the heart of all ghost stories, it's a human story. And humans just aren't all that different.
Well, and perhaps it's part of the drama of theater and people who inhabit those spaces.
It could very well be. Those type of people fill those roles, and then they go on to continue to fill those roles. I just did a discussion about haunted theaters in Wisconsin, and one of the ones I talked about was the Grand Opera in Oshkosh. It's not in the book, but it's still really interesting because it's considered one of our most haunted buildings. And the primary apparition there is a man named Percy Keene, and he worked at that theater from 1895 until he died in 1967. So he was there for 72 years, I believe, working there. So in that case, it's not hard for me to believe that his spirit lingers on there because that must have been the bulk of his life.
Yeah. We actually have our own haunted theater here in Milwaukee.
The Riverside is a noted haunted theater. We, of course, have the Modjeska Theater, which is supposed to be famously haunted. And as far as college campuses go, there claims to be two haunted theaters on Marquette's campus. So something about theaters is just a spirit magnet, and they all like to stay around.
Well, and Marquette is considered perhaps the most haunted campus in the state of Wisconsin.
Absolutely.
Where do ghosts seem to linger in Marquette?
Well, ghosts are attracted to that campus for a number of different reasons. And probably the most popular stories go back to dorms that had originally been used for something else. And you might know that one of the dorms used to be a children's hospital. And in that dorm, there are lots of ghostly tales of young patients that have still not made their way out of there. There is also famously a swimming ghost in that dorm who will take late night dips with unsuspecting swimmers. But that's not the only campus around that has these legends. There are stories that refer to Cardinal Stritch and Concordia, and there are even a few that are lingering, they say, at UW-Milwaukee.
At UW-Milwaukee. Are any of those in the book?
The UW-Milwaukee one did not make this book. It may make another, but there are a number of creepy campuses that are highlighted in the book. So it's lots of fun for me to do something like this because I love reading ghost books, but a lot of ghost books I read, I can't tell where they're talking about. And it's so incredibly vague that it could be anywhere. But in this book, there are pictures of the actual locations. The building is identified. It has the address when possible. And I like that for people who are extra curious or want to go to a haunted restaurant or want to drive by a haunted house or just like those stories. There's a little bit more there to cling on to.
Well, it's especially helpful because some of the buildings that might have had a specific name, I should say, mm-hmm. in the ghost story mm-hmm. now are used very differently. Going back to the campus theme, you mentioned right. MSOE and Blatt's Brewery.
Right. Valentin Blatt's story to me is really interesting because it is kind of a nutshell of Milwaukee because it has a beer baron, it has some populist ideas, it has a hard work ethic. It's very Milwaukee. So Valentin Blatt's immigrates to America. He ends up working for Braun, who has a brewery. And when he dies, when Braun dies, rather, Blatt's marries his widow, and then it becomes a Blatt's Brewery. And he is a very hardworking man, very well respected in Milwaukee. And you would not think a man like that, who was really known for being down to earth and not showy, would have any paranormal things about him at all. But he had a premonition that he was going to die if he ever went to California, which seems like a very easy thing to avoid. But his wife, every year, went to California to avoid winter. She was in poor health. And one year, she was just not feeling well, and he knew how much she wanted to go out there. And he's like, how am I letting this ridiculous premonition rule me? And so he's like, you know, this is silliness. He goes with her to California. While he's out there, he enters the beer into some contest that they would have not have been in because of his phobia of going to California, and they win. And it's really a long trip because that's how people used to travel at that time. And then it took them, you know, a number of days to get back. And he makes it all the way to St. Paul, and they stop for the night in St. Paul, the train does. And he ends up dying of a heart attack in St. Paul. So he comes back to Milwaukee, but not alive. And this happens so suddenly and so unexpectedly that when the newspapers contact their adult children to get a comment on this, they think it's a mistake. They're like, my dad's not dead. So what a terrible way to find out that your dad died. So they come back like a day later, you know, delay with the dead body. And then a few days later, he's laid to rest in the Forest Home Cemetery. And he was such a well-respected man that even though they wanted to have a private funeral for him, there was a line that took almost 3 hours to get through around their home of people who wanted to pay respect to this man. So that should be the end of this story. It's, you know, unusual that he had that premonition. But many, many people believe that a few days later, his spirit comes back to work and begins working in that office again. And this is such a pervasive belief that in the 1990s, people are still telling this story, and they're telling it even more after this becomes part of the MSOE campus. So as a lark, some of the people who work there pool their money together, and they get a psychic to come and do a seance with them on Halloween night in this office to see if they can summon Blatt's. And so, and I just want to pause to say, I know this story because it was actually in the Milwaukee Journal, published as news, which I love because throughout history, this kind of thing has been published in the paper. So as much as we might want to distance ourselves by being modern or sophisticated, it is so ingrained in our society. But I digress. So they have this seance, and these perfectly sane, employed, wonderful people say that they feel a presence in the room, and it becomes colder, and there's a breeze blowing through. And according to the people there that night, they could not summon Valentin Blatt's. However, they do think they connect it with a spirit that may have been involved in the business and did some shady accounting irregularities in the 1930s. And as somebody who is just looking at Milwaukee history, it really doesn't surprise me that Valentin Blatz would not come to a seance. Because I would imagine if you are a man who died and then returned to work, you have no time for foolishness. You are in that office for a reason. You're building your empire. So it doesn't surprise me that they wouldn't. But I think the better part of that story is how much it has captured the imagination of generations of Milwaukeeans and how we're still interested in that story.
Well, there are other ghosts of this ilk, specifically in downtown Milwaukee.
Absolutely.
There's, of course, the Pfister ghost.
Yes.
There's the ghost at the Eagles Club. I actually did a piece on the Eagles Club not so long ago, and I will say the number one thing that everyone asked about as I was doing this research is, oh, well, are you researching the ghost? Because apparently this is a huge thing. So I know a bit of this story at this point, but the information has come from a lot of odd sources. What's the story behind the Eagles Club ghost?
Well, you know, that's a great question because I think that I maybe give in the book an overview that there may not be a reasonable story about the rave or Eagles Room ghost. There is definitely someone who did die in the Eagles Club, and they died in the pool. So all of that is very true. However, a lot of the other stories that you hear about, like roaming bands of sinister children, it's really hard to track down historically what could have happened that would cause there to be a group of sinister children that are lurking in the night, because there have been no, at least that I'm aware of, no mass casualty of a number of children. There was no terrible accident where several kids died at the same time or anything. So I'm not sure where those otherworldly children would be, but there are so many stories with that building, and it's really fascinating, and I think it's definitely part of the mystique of going there.
So if you're someone who is reading this book, you know, you're really intrigued about a lot of these ghosts and these legends. You know, as a tour guide in Milwaukee, where would you suggest that they go?
Well, two of my favorite places are, of course, we cannot ignore the Pfister Hotel. The Pfister is Milwaukee's most famously haunted building. And beyond having, in my opinion, one of the most cordial, welcoming ghosts of the whole city, it's an incredibly beautiful place to be. So even if nothing spine-tingling happens, you are going to have an amazing time because it's just truly such a beautiful building. And I have a personal fondness for City Hall because it's so amazingly historic and it's beautiful, and I feel such a sense of civic pride when I'm in there. And even if the stories that are connected to it aren't your cup of tea, you're still going to get a great piece of Milwaukee history there.
All right. Well, Anna, thank you so much for coming in and speaking with me today and telling me a bit about our ghost history.
I thank you so much for having me. I really do appreciate this opportunity.
Anna Lardinoy is the author of Milwaukee Ghosts and Legends, as well as the founder of Gothic Milwaukee, where she gives haunted, historical walking tours of the city. Our interview first aired last month.
We'd like to end our show today with a song from Milwaukee-based singer-songwriter Brittany Freeman Farr, also known as Be Free. Here she is with the song No More.
Said you wouldn't do it again, but then you went and did it again, again, again. Pain is trying to ease my mind, but it ain't working. I'm hyperventilating from the way that you hurt, and your love is hurting. But one thing's for certain, that I don't want to do this no more. I can't keep crying, trying to make you see. Don't want to do this no more. Love is dying and you can't be. Wanna do this no more, hurts no more, can't hurt no more. don't want to do this no more, no, no more. What you mean is over? Heart keeps screaming and bleeding for my love for you, but I need to get over pain inside. Everything that's causing me to lose my mind. Said that you were gonna change. Seem to think that me staying the same. Throwing all the games, I gotta get sane, sane from the pain. I'm trying to ease my mind, cause it ain't working. I took a chance, stuck around, but I'm still hurting. Your love is hurting, but I'm so certain that I don't wanna do this no more. Can't keep crying, trying to make you see. Don't wanna do this no more. Love is dying and you can't be the one for me. Don't wanna do this no more. Us no more, can't hurt no more. So I don't wanna do this no more. No, no more. I say no, no, no more. I didn't wanna see, but I could finally breathe the truth. No, no more. The only wrong I found in me was in the me and you. But I wanna change, I wanna live this away. No more sitting down. I'm so tired, do this no more. Yeah, yeah. I don't wanna do this no. I said I don't wanna hurt and cry no more, no more. Said I don't wanna hurt and cry no more, no more. No more, no more, no more. Oh, na 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 na. I'm so tired, tired. No, no, no. So sing it, sing it. No more, I can't do no more, no more. I can't do no more, no more. 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 No more, no more.
That was Be Free with the original song No More. Be Free will be performing this Friday for the relaunch of Higher Education Records at Company Brewing. This song was recorded during our interview with her in August.
And that's all for the Wednesday edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Keep listening. It's 11 o'clock, and fresh air comes your way next.